Matt Segundo here, and this week we have four authors writing against the apocalypse. There's little I can say to introduce these authors, except to say that all of them are men, and Jorge has all of their phone numbers, and I don't know why. But I'd like to clarify a few rumors that have come up on my MySpace page. Apparently, many people want to be my friend. Claire Cameron writes, "There are no free drinks on MySpace, you know. On the contrary, I have been in touch with several charming MySpace users, including Sex for You." That's apparently the numeral four rather than the word. "I put out and come to my place." "These three charming ladies have promised to deliver a bottle of tequila to my Motel 6 room as soon as I give them my credit card number. How considerate of them." Sam Lipsight writes, "What were you thinking? You smell like roast beef." I've never met this Lipsight fellow, and I'm sure he's just as questionable as the rest of these blackguards who question my presence, but I can assure all of my listeners that my wardrobe carries the distinguished smell of tequila. It's not so bad. Finally, John writes, "Make sure not to get too carried away with the glitter graphics." I don't know what he means, but if he's referring to my first radio job DJing at an FM glam rock station, I can assure him that those days are long and gone. I needed to get my start somewhere. But enough about me. Let our young roving correspondent carry out the rest of the show.
Okay, I'm here with Todd Taylor, the author of Shirley Wins, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, well, why don't you tell us about Shirley Wins, and you're on this Joe Mino tour as well.
That is correct. Shirley Wins is my first novel, second book, and it's about a grandmother and a granddaughter that invent a human-powered cannon that launches pumpkins.
Why pumpkins?
There's actually a pumpkin launching contest that Shirley finds in a newspaper and slowly evolves into making the more sophisticated weapon.
Okay, that I get, but why personally pumpkins?
Why personally pumpkins is I wanted something as large as possible that grows organically that could actually put into a cannon. And like my grandfather was in the Navy, and I remember they had 16-inch barrels as a kid. And I was thinking, what can fit in a 16-inch barrel? A pumpkin. That's it.
Was Halloween a favorite holiday of yours? Or?
I love Halloween. Halloween is probably the best holiday there is. Anybody, any reason to dress up and scare people and steal candy from kids and go to the 99-cent store and just see so many great skeleton masks and stuff like that, best holiday ever.
So the cannon, then, is a way to get it for the other 364 days, perhaps?
Yes, indeed.
What would the style of this book be? And also, maybe you could tie this in, because I know also you edit a punk site as well.
Yes. Well, the style of this book, I really wanted to develop a character and characters that wouldn't necessarily think of punk rock in any way, shape, or form. That I wanted to have like a unique situation, because I don't know any books really about grandmothers, and especially grandmother-granddaughter. The mother in the middle, she dies at childbirth. So I try to make a nice book, a book that I think people would be expecting for somebody my age having an angsty, I'm an angry youth male protagonist. And I really wanted to take myself out of that. And I've been reading a lot of Steinbeck and Nelson Algren, and a lot of the criticism against them was that the only women they wrote really, really convincingly about were whores, prostitutes and whores, and whores. And they rarely had, or like there's sometimes a mother figure, but they were always kind of trapped in these very large dilemmas that they never got out of. So I try to think of something nice, but make her human, not make it a parody, and also give her like conflict. I mean, the thing I feel bad about Shirley in Shirley Wins is she gets mauled. She gets really, really hurt. You know, there's a lot of geriatric hijinks in it, but it's for just to provide tension, to provide, like, show how serious these weapons are for her and how she tries to develop them.
That would be sadistic, I think. Are you one of those sadistic T.C. Boyle-like authors? Or?
No. I think I just wanted to show, like, I mean, I've done a lot of dumb things in my life. I've done a lot of things that have really hurt me. I've, burned eyebrows, shot my glasses off, gotten fingers broken, burned fingers. And I wanted to show that these things aren't easy. These transitions in life will provide physical and mental pain and anguish. But if you have a greater goal in mind, that those are just secondary. You know, those are secondary to actually trying to say, hey, my life isn't what I want it to be, and then following something as on the surface absurd as making a pumpkin cannon and going after something that she can claim that is her own.
Was it difficult to generate conflict with the grandparents? Or?
No, not really. I think a lot of it's internal conflict. It's a lot of like life of the mind. She had abandoned doing physics and engineering in high school. It really had a good affinity to. But like kind of like my mother and grandmother got jobs early on, and they were secretaries and kind of moved up. And they don't resent their jobs, and they're really good at them. But there wasn't that spark behind their eyes. And for my real grandmother, she got into gardening, and she got into very quiet activities like knitting and made these very elaborate things. And I kind of melded those ideas with my grandfather was an actual inventor and did, you know, made really like crazy stuff. And I tried to put the two together. You know, try to like making sure like my grandfather did things like, well, he actually helped invent tail hooks for landing on aircraft carriers during World War II. And he also wanted to do underground cities. So I kind of tried to put those two things together.
Now, is your grandmother still alive? Or?
No, actually, my grandmother's the reason I moved out to Los Angeles over 10 years ago. I had been accepted to a PhD program in southern Mississippi. And when I called my mother, I was having indecision about it. I actually drove out to Mississippi. And she said, your grandma's really, really sick. If you can, you know, you can say no, but you can come and take care of her. And so I moved out to Camarillo, which is 60 miles north of Los Angeles, and didn't really take care of her. I just hung out with her for a while. And then she got better and convalesced, and I moved down to Pasadena, and we stayed in contact for the next 2 years, and then she died after that. But I felt really, really lucky to find so much of a connection with somebody, like, just by blood, you know, but there's so many years and so many experiences. She's a deeply religious lady. But we had so much in common, and that was kind of like the genesis of this, like the heart feelings behind Shirley Wentz. I kind of want to do like a kind of eulogy to my grandmother and by association my mother, who are very similar. So that's why I did that.
Well, thanks so much, Todd.
Thank you.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Okay, I am here with Todd Dills, who is the author of Sons of the Rapture, as well as the journal, The Second Hand. Todd, how are you doing?
Oh, doing great.
So, tell us about Sons of the Rapture, and maybe we could start from there, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about The Second Hand as well.
Okay. Well, Sons of the Rapture is a novel. It's my first one. Came out a couple months ago with on a new press in Chicago called Featherproof Books. I can't say enough good things about them. They're fucking awesome, but... Sons of the Rapture sort of developed organically after I wrote a short story about a young man. It sort of sprung from an incident in my childhood where I was picked up by the U.S. Senator Strom Thurmond at a sort of a small town barbecue that in my mom's hometown, Silver Street, South Carolina, and it was a horrifying experience to say the least. Strom was a very old man, and even then, that was in the 70s, and he was probably, you know, approaching 80 at that point. But anyway, it sprung from sort of remembering that, and anyway, I had this. My father was a very sort of anti Strom Thurmond guy, and. I had this sort of wishful idea that I created this alternate history for my father, and he was a sort of a left-wing reactionary, and also acting on some very personal issues. There was a rumor that his
left-wing reactionary.
No, he's a
That's interesting.
That's not what I meant. Left-wing revolutionary in South Carolina. Very, very strange idea that wasn't going on in the '60s, but And he was also acting on some sort of personal hatred for this particular senator. And so he the character in the novel, his name is Johnny Jones, runs his Pontiac GTO into the float which is a big white whale that Strom, that the Senator Thorpe Storm, as he's called in the book, is on, coming down the first float out of the gate on this this sort of spring festival. And the book kind of proceeded from there and sort of drew, sort of followed the life of his son a little bit more. It's about basically it's about him, Billy Jones, who moves from South Carolina to Chicago and in the mid-90s and gets involved with some host of very cast characters and basically just becomes obsessed with his own past in South Carolina. I mean, that's the general idea, I suppose.
Did you write this novel when Strom Thurmond was alive, or...?
I started it when he was alive, and I bookended it by it starts on the day that they took the in 2001 when they took the Confederate flag down from the state capitol. Billy's watching all this from afar in Chicago, I knew, like, I was waiting for kind of, I started this and started writing it about 2000-2001, around that time, and just kind of waiting. I had this idea that I would end it, I'd be able to end it and figure out the timeline for the events in the book when Strom Thurmond finally died, which he did finally in 2003, so that provided the end for me. And I got 2 years in there. That's a perfect bookends for South Carolina political and cultural history, I think. So it's a good way to get into some of those issues.
So the gist I'm getting here is that if you're writing about a major sort of historical figure who's currently living, the best way to do it is to write him when he's in his 90s or is about to on his death's door.
I think so. It's not totally about him. I mean, the senator is pretty well fictionalized as well. So, you know, nobody ever ran a car into Strom Thurmond's float in any town parade, but you know what I mean.
Now, you moved from North Carolina to Chicago. What would you say would be this kind of fusion? What have you picked up from Chicago? What have you picked up from North Carolina in terms of when you write something or when you edit the second hand?
Well, I mean, in Chicago, what Chicago has done for me, and I've been there about 8 years, it's kind of this... In sort of direct opposition to the way things work down south, there's actually like a public there, a reading public, and so like I've been editing this broadsheet and doing a lot of readings and doing release events and just meeting a lot of great people. So it just sort of got me very comfortable with sort of, you know, sharing my stuff with other people, like really getting it out there. And I think that helped me in the writing process as well. Like doing this book, various parts in this book sort of developed in front of a crowd, really. I mean, I sort of spent a lot of time doing reading parts of it at events, for fragments and stuff, and just gauging audience response and talking to people about it. And it's come together pretty well, I think.
So, if there's a writer from North Carolina who's listening to this, you would urge them to move to Chicago because the literary community is necessary, like this?
No, I don't know. Not necessary for me. And I actually moved from South Carolina.
I'm sorry.
Strom Thurmond is the North Carolina version of Strom would be Helms, but I don't want to go there.
That'll be the next novel, huh?
But maybe, I don't know. But I don't know. I wouldn't recommend it. If you're young. Why not? You know, I mean, that's I moved to Chicago when I was 21. I'm 30 at this point, but I think it was the perfect thing for me at the time. I mean, I was just kind of, I was in South Carolina, worked 21, worked in a restaurant, just graduated from college, worked in a restaurant, you know, and sort of sped my way out of there as quickly as I could because I didn't see any way of doing anything else. So I felt kind of trapped by the, I don't know, by the.
Why Chicago over New York? That's what I want to ask.
Oh, why Chicago? Well, actually, it was either Chicago or New York. And I got into the Columbia College MFA program there, and I felt really good about it. I went up there and met a lot of great people. And,
is that where you met Joe?
That actually is where I met Joe. Joe Mino, he contributed a piece of fiction to the third issue of The Second Hand. And he was actually at Columbia at the time. I think he was beginning to teach around that time, and I was in my like second or third year in the program, and we just met that way through the second year. I hadn't met him before then, but that was fortuitous because we became really good friends. And actually, should probably say I'm moving away from Chicago in 2 weeks, going back to the South.
Really?
Yeah, man. I got to get some work done in Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm going to try that for a while and see how that works. The triumphant return. Or the hanging your head in shame return. I don't know.
I don't know about that. There's plenty of great writers from the South.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, totally. Yeah. I'm just joking. But, yeah.
All right. Well, Todd, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, but nobody searches. Nobody cares somehow.
All right, so I am here with Bucky Sinister, the author of Whiskey and Robots. Bucky, how are you doing, and how did you come up with a combo like that?
Whiskey and Robots?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was, I actually was trying to arrange all the poems, and I had them in different envelopes according to what the subject matter was, because I had a lot of kind of repetitive stuff, and I was putting the whole book together. It took like a couple, like I think about 7 years of writing, and I had like a... It turned out to be the last envelope that I had was all the whiskey poems and all the robots poems, and it was just only envelopes of whiskey and robots. And I used that same envelope to put together the final manuscript. So on the manuscript, it said Whiskey Robots, and it just kind of like everyone kind of thought that was a title. And it, so I was like, well, everybody's like, that's a great title. I'm like, oh yeah. That's, so it was kind of an accident, but everyone thought it was great, so I kept it.
What were some of the titles on the other envelopes? What were the other possibilities?
Well, the envelopes were just like, there were like angel poems, things like that. They were just like kind of by subject, like relationship poems and that one. And like, you know, at one point when I got near the end, I just had, I was trying to pick which one's about whiskey, which one's about robots. And that was kind of, I had enough for one envelope there. And so it was just happened to be that like these are on the subject of whiskey and robots, and other people saw it and they're like, oh, that's a good title. I'm like, oh yes, thank you. Like, you know, it's like the thing, if anyone accuses you of brilliance, take full credit. And that's what I say.
Now, you read poems tonight about the alternative universe of Bruce Wayne as well as NASCAR, and let's talk about this. Why do you think poetry sort of shies away from cultural references like this?
Well, I don't really know. I think people, like, they want to sound smarter, you know, and there's this kind of, like, there's this bias against a lot of current stuff, you know, and really if you go back, like people were always using, like, characters and other stories that were familiar to them. And in a lot of classic poetry, it's like references from Homer, or it's the Iliad, you know, the Odyssey, a lot from the Bible, because that's what they knew. That's like the only books they, like, if some guy only had the Bible around, that's the only stories he heard. Yeah, he'll make a lot of biblical references. You know, but people, like, what people know and how we relate to people through metaphor now is like, I think, you know, these are terms in which I think, and I think a lot of other people do too. You know, it's like I can, you know, like instead of, you know, these classic figures like, you know, Perseus and just, you know, like Icarus and any of these other classic figures, you know, I have like Dale Earnhardt and Elvis, you know, because that's what people know. People, if you say Elvis, they get a picture in their mind of a specific guy.
Well, it depends, fat or thin Elvis.
Yeah, totally. And see, there you go. You can say fat Elvis, and people think of a specific thing. Whereas you say Icarus, then they don't really know what to picture. You know, they maybe think of like a statue or maybe some drawing, but not everybody's thinking of the same thing. You know, and it's like. Like, there's, like, you know, I mentioned before in the reading, it's like Gilligan's a good one. If you say, like, he's wearing a Gilligan hat, you're thinking of one specific hat, you know, and that's, and it's fine. I think that should be used if, you know, if it's genuine, you know, it's like you should really use, as far as metaphors and imagery, you should use things that are genuine to you, things you really like, things that really do speak for you.
But one might argue that, like, high cultural, so-called high cultural references can be genuine. Maybe
they can. They might be. I mean, if you really do read all the classic Greek tales and whatnot, yeah, use it. But if you don't use it. And I think that's what a lot of people do. They want to use these kind of highbrow references to make themselves sound smarter. Like, you know, they learn like one story, like the one I was talking before is like Icarus. A lot of people kind of know a general thing about the story, but who's actually read the story he comes from? I mean, people are like, oh, he tried to fly out of the sun on these fake wings and then he fell. But do you really, have you even read the story, or is that something you heard? You heard the story retold. Like, it's just like, you know, like, it's just these kind of classical references are like, yeah, if you're really into them and you really know the story and you really like them, fine, use them. But, you know, if, you know, just use what you know, mostly.
Well, but then I would also counter-argue by saying that, you know, poets who are entertaining, like yourself, may have the ability to make something like Icarus accessible to everybody and memorable.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, and that's always possible. You know, it's just kind of more how you use things, always not what you use, you know. I don't know. Like, I got some things in there. Like, a lot, there's a lot of subtle references that people don't always pick up on, and it's fine. I kind of like the art to be like, well, you know what? On the surface, this is entertaining on its own. And if you have a deeper understanding of who these people are, you get it on another level. And I that's why I like a lot of art. I like to be able to look at a painting and like it and understand what it is without having to know, like, what the artist's process was. That's like a second level of appreciation, to understand, like, you know, who the artist was, like, what he represented, and, like, you know, where his subject matter came from. And I think, like, you know, a lot of my stuff is like that. Like, I have a whole thing about you know, Wayne Gretzky retiring and going and playing hockey with Eddie Shore and Gordie Howe. And they all hang out at Dairy Queen together. And it's not really important that you know who any of these hockey players are, but if you do know, it adds a whole other level, because they start fighting Wayne Gretzky and he can't fight. Why is that funny? It's funny to hockey fans, because they all know that Gretzky couldn't fight. And, you know, the idea of Bobby Orr and Gordie Howe roughing him up is kind of funny. But it's kind of funny even if you don't get it. And that's, like, that's how I like the art to be. It's like the references and stuff, that's a second level. You don't have to get them to enjoy it.
Steve Martin has Picasso at the La Fine Gilles. You have Wayne Gretzky at the Dairy Queen.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go.
All right, well, Bucky, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Joe Mino, author of The Boy Detective Fails. How are you doing, Joe?
Great, thanks, Ed.
You drove all the way here from Portland the same day. It's crazy.
Yeah,
man.
I'm on this a great tour with Todd Taylor and Todd Dills, and we're doing 8 cities in 7 days. So it's been pretty rigorous traveling, but we've been great. We've had great turnouts and. Audience's response has been great, and this is like the first tour that I've done since Hairstyles of the Dam came out 2 years ago, and it's actually the first time people are bringing copies of my old books and then copies of the new book to the show, which is just really, really amazing.
Is 12 hours a day of driving what it takes for an independent sort of, you know?
Well, I mean, there's so many books being published right now, and there's limited space for what books get reviewed in different magazines, and the only way to get a local Arts Weekly or some local paper to write about your book is to actually show up and do a reading in the town. So, and it's really interesting because I've done a lot of touring in the last couple of years, and when you do a reading, even if only 10 or 15 people show up, if a bookstore displays your book for a week or two before the event, or if the local paper runs a review, you might sell 10 times as many. And they have this thing called BookScan, which was started a few years ago, where they can actually track the book sales by region. And I can look and see all the places that I've toured in the last month and see the effect it's had on sales. So it's a really important component for independent publishing.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about The Boy Detective Fails.
Sure.
I actually wanted to tie it into Hairstyles, because both of these books deal with adolescence. I was wondering what actually sort of, you know, attracts you to this whole adolescent theme.
Definitely Hairstyles is about, yeah, the 17-year-old kid Brian, and about...
In a different sense, this
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, I think... The Boy Detective Fails, for me, I wanted to do something very different in tone and very different in mood, and it's a lot more surreal, and there's these kind of absurd moments. And it's not about adolescence, but about what happens when you turn 30 and realize that the world is this complicated place that doesn't necessarily have an answer to everything. So although, like, the first part of the book is about this boy and how he becomes a detective and his adolescence, which is very perfect. It's almost the complete opposite of Brian Oswald's life in Hairstyles of the Dam, where it's very conflicted. It's very, you know, when I was writing that book, I wanted it to almost be like a documentary. It's very realistic. Billy Argo's life as an adolescent is very dreamy and pastoral almost, where these, you know, everything goes right. He gets his name in the paper for solving crimes. And because of that, because of his success at such a young age, and the suicide of his younger sister, who is his crime-solving partner as a child, he has a really difficult time becoming an adult. So at the age of 30, he's really coming to this understanding about how complicated being an adult is in this world where there's this state of kind of constant chaos.
Well, it's I mentioned adolescence because I actually have an interesting sort of broader term of it than
sure.
maybe you might be thinking of.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, we've been seeing like a lot of books lately, like Ben Kunkel's Indecision,
uh-huh.
all these sorts of growing up sorts of
sure.
books, and your book sort of ties into that, but at the same time, there's an element of another type of book that I'm seeing emerge, particularly from indie presses. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Sam Savage's Furman.
No, I haven't read that book.
You gotta read it. It's in many ways, I was reading this book, and it sort of seemed to me like, you know, how much of this guy's life can you actually believe in? How much of it is fictional? How much of it is real and fictional? I mean, and it's sort of like, there's this kind of interesting new sort of attitude of like a misfit sort of grappling onto fiction as a sort of crutch to some degree. I mean, was this kind of a factor when you were writing the book?
No, I mean, the book was, it came out of my love of children's detective fiction and books like The Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and also the Dick Tracy comic strip that used to run in the Sunday paper. And this idea of children solving crimes and dealing with the adult world and doing it really well as children. And the idea of a mystery novel is always something that's really interesting to me, in that at the end this great mystery is solved and how unlike life is in accordance with that kind of storytelling. So it was kind of that sense of the children's mystery novel and then wondering what this character would be like as an adult. And at the time that I started writing it, it was about 2002. It was a year after September 11th and just a few months before the beginning of the Iraq War. And I was turning 30 at the time, and I felt like the world had become infinitely more complicated, infinitely more complex. There was this sense of very pervasive evil. There was this sense of not knowing the answers to what was going to happen next. And I thought, you know, what would a character like Billy Argo, a 30-year-old former child detective, do in this situation? How would he kind of navigate the world? And in the story, in the novel, he lives in this town where office buildings are just disappearing and no one knows why. There's these evil characters that ride his ex-nemesis, Professor Von Gollum, rides the bus, and he's constantly coming up against these mysteries that don't have a simple solution. So for me, at least, a novel is a kind of synthesis of a lot of different ideas or a lot of different questions that I have, and by writing it, then I'm trying to come up with some answers, at least for myself.
Well, one of the things, I mean, kind of going into this notion of, like, fiction versus real world, since you are actually playing off of a certain convention about, like, Encyclopedia Brown books, this could have very easily turned into some sort of really sort of wicked kind of satire.
Right,
or something.
Right.
And yet, when I was reading it, I got the sense that it was really sort of this heartfelt attempt to kind of take this world, however real, however fictive, seriously.
Right. I mean, I think that was really important. I think sometimes irony is completely overdone or overabused, and I think it's really easy in your 20s to adopt this jaded or ironic stance towards everything. And the older I've gotten, I think the more I'm interested in things that are sincere, or people that are sincere, or people that are genuine. And that's, you know, at the heart of the book, what this character Billy Argo is searching for, you know. And he finds it in these other characters in the story. One is this lady, Penny Maple, who's a pickpocket that he meets on the bus. And the other are these two children who live across the street from him, Effie and Gus Mumford, that he befriends. And it's in those moments, meeting these other characters, that the complexity of the world doesn't seem so daunting. And that's how I feel as a 32-year-old adult in the world, that even though in 2006, you know, we're still at war, there's this certainly questionable regime that's running the country, and the world doesn't seem like it's getting any easier, the moments where I feel less anxious or I feel like I'm not overwhelmed by this sense of mystery in the world is when I'm with other people, and when, you know, I can have a conversation, and that sense of finding redemption just in being around other human beings, you know. And that I didn't want it to be an ironic kind of like wink at the audience. I really feel sincere about that.
And yet there are certain kinds of
you know, things in this book, for example, like, you know, chapter 14 gone missing,
right,
directly addressing the reader. You too can actually help by cracking the
right,
code. And
right,
of course the little cryptogram that, uh-huh, you know, which, you know, incidentally, Derek's secret adventure, I did in fact deduce it myself.
That's
but,
great.
But, you know, I guess
that's less, though, to me, out of a sense of irony and more out of what the book is actually about. For me, the book is about how, as an adult, you negotiate a world of mystery, a world where you don't have the answers. And so I wanted the audience or the reader, as they are reading, to feel that sense of surprise, that when you're a kid and you get a detective kit and you look at the world a little bit differently because of that object. And so I wanted the actual text to be surprising, though, as you were reading through it, you weren't exactly sure technically what was going to happen, if you'd have a couple pages that were blank, or if you'd have some of the text that's broken up into these small little buildings that go throughout the book, or if there'd be a piece of text that was shaped like a cloud. And so that, you know, using the text itself to give that sense of mystery or surprise to the audience as they were going through.
There's also another sense beyond the notion of, like, you know, a child kind of transforming into adult. There seemed to me, with the telemarketing firm, like this general sense that culture is declaring an assault upon playfulness. That's what I got anyway.
Well, and that's really important. I think the book, you know, most books are about characters or coming of age, and they realize something, a truth about the world that changes them, that forces them to grow and move forward. And this book is actually the opposite. It's about a character that comes to this realization that there's a lot of necessity in the idea of mystery, that there's something beautiful in being surprised by something. There's something beautiful about sitting on a bus and seeing two people kiss. And there's something lovely and redemptive in that, and it goes against the sense of rationality that you develop as an adult. It's actually realizing that you have a lot of the answers when you're a kid and you allow yourself to make believe for a little bit. And it's the same reason there's, again, like the decoder ring in the book, because I wanted the audience, if they so desired, to have to take the 5 minutes to cut the thing out, put it together, and then do the actual physical unscrambling of the code. Because when's the last time did you have the opportunity to actually decode something, you know? And so that sense of playfulness is, I think it's key. I think it's the thing that keeps you alive and keeps you, you know, in love with the world and not terrified by it.
And yet at the same time, though, at the end of this book, which I won't get anything away, there's still a considerable quandary here in mm-hmm. the sense that, like, the ending was just like, I was both, you know, saddened, but also, you know, happy by this, because no, there are no sort of actual sort of choices. It's like, no, what has he decided exactly? You know,
right,
and,
right.
And I won't say, but
no,
I mean,
but it's important. You know. It's a mystery, and at the end of the story, there's more questions, and I think that's, again, I mean, even though the book is very surreal and there's all these absurd kind of things happening, it's that idea of that. You never come to an ending, or you never really solve that mystery. It only leads to another question. That seemed really important. I didn't want it to be a mystery in the conventional sense of a mystery novel, where you get to the end, you find out why this person did this, end of story. I wanted it to be about this character realizing that you might come to the end of a certain part of your life, and that only leads to more questions.
Yeah. There were two authors, two Marks, as a matter of fact, who I seemed to detect a kind of influence by. There were, you know, first of all, the sort of formatting of the text reminded me very much of House of Leaves, Mark Danielewski.
I haven't read that book.
Really?
No, but I've heard really good things about it.
You'd be surprised, because it seemed like, you know, he does the same thing where he has, like, a line on a page, like,
uh-huh.
you know, during the portion of this thing.
Uh-huh.
It's almost dead exactly. It's interesting.
Wow.
And then, also, of course, Mark Haddon's The Curious Incident of the Dog at Nighttime.
I haven't. Oh, I've read, yeah, The Curious
yeah.
Dog. There's actually the two books that I was kind of thinking about in the back of my mind, or two writers. One was Alejandro Baracco, who's an Italian writer. He wrote a book called Silk. And what was really interesting to me about his work, or that what I kind of borrowed from, is he had a lot of the book is really short. It's a novel, but a lot of the chapters are actual single sentences. And Faulkner does that in a couple of his books. And As They Lay Dying, there's a chapter that's a single sentence. And just really looking at how you can compress a story to its most essential moments, its most essential elements. And the other writer was Donald Bartlemy, who wrote these really absurd, really short, dreamy, very punchy stories. And every time I read his stuff, I feel just like my sense of imagination and the possibility of the world just kind of opening up. So those two writers were definitely in the back of my mind as I was writing the book.
Specifically, like those text box diagrams that are aligned to like the, you know, lower right hand corner.
Those are buildings.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, for I really like looking at how the content of the book shapes the actual structure. So my last book, Hairstyles of the Dam, was about kids in love with music, and it was really about mixtapes and the power of mixtapes. And so for that book, structurally, I wanted it to be like a mixtape, so really short chapters and some very chaotic, some longer and different tones. And so as you're reading it, you have the similar sensation as you do listening to a mixtape. You get all these different moments kind of strung together. And for this book, as I was writing it and realizing this book is really about mystery and order and how as humans we constantly crave order and the answer to everything, I came up with a structure that was very orderly. So it's 100 chapters. The book is 100 chapters. It's very symmetrical. There's a prologue and an epilogue. Each of those are 5 chapters. Then there's 3 main parts to the book, and each of those are 30. So that adds up to this very symmetrical 100 chapters. And then I realized that the book is really not about order. The book is about appreciating mystery and disorder. So to investigate that structurally, I came up with this idea. In the book, these buildings disappear in the town, and they don't really, they kind of figure out why, but it doesn't end. You know, the boy detective isn't able to stop these buildings from disappearing. And so I came up with the idea of having actual buildings of text that appear randomly throughout the book. So those buildings of text are kind of fighting against the actual order, 100 chapters of the book. And so just really simply the idea is you're reading a really orderly book and then this strange magical thing appears on the page and then you go back to the book and you don't know when that next moment is going to occur again. And so it's, you know, it's going back to that idea of understanding or appreciating the beauty of something mysterious.
I know that you have also written plays, and I know that also The Boy Detective Fails was
a play
as well. I'm wondering if this kind of concern for structure comes from that.
It occurs kind of towards the end of the first draft of a book where I have a sense of here's the characters, this is what this thing's about, and how can I write this, how can I use the structure to tell the story more clearly in an interesting way, you know, and I'm not a postmodernist. I don't believe that all the great stories have already been told. But I think one of the things that keeps people reading is how inventive writers are with how they tell a story, you know. And so I think unlike people who read 100 or even 50 years ago, people who read now have been inundated with storytelling of every kind. Unlike any generation before this, we have film, we have television, we have theater, we have books. And on top of all that, we have the VCR. And that, I think, people were able or are able to read and rewatch movies again and again. So they're way more savvy about storytelling. And like my wife, when we go to a movie, she can, you know, we'll sit down and watch the film for a couple minutes, and she knows like that character is going to end up with this person. She just knows because she's seen so much film and read so many books, and so. One of the ways that you help surprise your audience or, you know, keep them engaged in the book is to experiment and come up with the structure, the actual way the story is told in an interesting way. And the way that I work a lot is I take a story, and usually it'll start off as a short story, and then write it as a play to help figure out what the structure is or the basic characters or scenes. And then if it's something I really like that's really interesting, I'll try it out as a novel. And so that's what happened with The Boy Detective.
Well, going back to this notion of inventiveness, I find that the inventiveness of this, at least, is extremely sort of understated. And I see, you know, this is one of the things that unfortunately gives postmodernism a bad rap, or experimentalism, whatever that may be.
Right, right.
You know, whether it may be, you know, experimental or not. It's that kind of nature of awareness. I was wondering what steps you took to sort of iron that down to get it absolutely sort of nuanced and not sort of obtrusive, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's really important, too, that it's not... that the story is what's most important. The characters, for me, are what most important, and not the tricks or those things you might be doing technically. All that should hopefully be really seamless and invisible. You know, not to say that as you cut out the decoder ring, you're not thinking about, like, oh, this is pretty odd, or as you see these different things, you're not surprised by it, but that it doesn't jar you or prevent you from moving forward in the book. And I think a lot of it is just rewriting. The other thing, this is my fourth novel, and I feel like because of the success of Hairstyles, I could take a little more risk with some of those technical aspects in the actual structure of the book. And it was something that I felt was really important. I didn't want to rewrite or write a sequel to Hairstyles. I really love that book. It's important to me, but I feel like I'm done with it. So I wanted to try to do some things technically. I want to do some things on the page that I hadn't necessarily seen done before, and having a decoder ring and using the text in some different ways seemed like a good way to help establish this book as its own thing. So that's also part of it too. And the last thing is, I'm a big fan of reading my work to an audience, and I feel like that's the best way to know if it's working or not. And so reading different parts of it to an audience as I was writing it and working on it was really, really helpful in me making decisions about whether something was distracting in the text or whether something stayed because it felt like it was strong.
Gotcha. Hang on one second. Actually, I wanted to ask you about the fixation of colors in this book.
Okay.
Particularly yellow. There's a lot of, like, this yellow suitcase, and a lot of yellow sartorial sort of choices.
Really?
Yeah, I noticed this.
Well, Each character has their own color in the book. So it's like a comic strip where, you know, in Dick Tracy is yellow, and each character has their own, like, identifiable color. So, like, Billy is blue and orange, and Penny is pink and brown, and Effie Mumford is purple and white. His little sister Caroline, who dies, is gold. And I was definitely influenced by comic strips like Dick Tracy, and also by modern comic book artists like Dan Clowes and Chris Ware, kind of building on that tradition and doing new and wonderful things with it. And so having that kind of monochromatic tone to each character was a way to connect to that history of the comic book.
And the other thing, too, I mean, we never really saw the Encyclopedia Brown books, that sense of color.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So it seems that you were kind of running with the ball and kind of expanding it forward by adding, like, the colors.
Right,
by
right.
adding some of these little, you know, notations that were just... And that's the other thing. What did you do to sort of get this kind of very... It was a sort of idiosyncratic declarative sentence structure in the sense that it was, like, slightly formal, but yet not. And I was wondering, how did this kind of come about?
You know? I have a great editor, Dan Sinker, who actually edits Punk Planet. He's the publisher of Punk Planet, and he's the editor of Punk Planet Books. And like Hairstyles, after I finished the manuscript and rewrote it a number of times myself, I gave him a copy. And we actually sit down, and I go through the book word by word with him, and he asked me questions about word choice and sentence punctuation and structure, and do you really need this word maybe here? Isn't it stronger if that word isn't here? And so having a really strong first reader like that to ask you questions about the tone and the language choice that you're using is really important. Yeah, the book, though, has this very, at times, very formal kind of sensibility to it. And what I wanted to actually... The narrator of the book is the town itself. It's we, and the town is telling the story about Billy Argo and how Billy is an important part of the town. And so there's a kind of that we storyteller connects to this great tradition of folk tales. A lot of folk tales have this we tradition. And there's other couple novels like, or short stories like Barn Burning by William Faulkner, which is we, and it's about this, the town as it views one of its character. And it has this really strange, surreal formality to it. Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Genetes is written in that fourth person too. So it's a cool, it kind of occupies two spaces, like the storyteller, this all-knowing person, but also when it says we on some subconscious level, it gives you a sense of intimacy too.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about the swiftness of the chapters.
Okay.
And how it didn't seem to be necessarily an homage to Encyclopedia Brown, but I was wondering if it's just a case of like you sort of having to get in a little piece of writing in one sitting.
No, I worked really, really hard. I'm an overwriter, and that's the way I write. You know, to write one good story, I probably write 10 bad ones, and to write a novel that's 300 pages, I'm going to probably write 600, and especially with this kind of book where it's very, very compressed, and there's 100 chapters, and each of them, some of them are only a sentence long. It wasn't me as a writer being lazy. It was me writing a lot and then really chopping down. So it's like if you were a sculptor using lots and lots of clay and then getting rid of it until you have the shape of the thing that you want. And for me, like, it was less about Encyclopedia Brown and more about giving these short, brief moments in Billy's life that I thought were important. And it's also really readable, and a lot of my favorite novels use that kind of short chapter form where you read two pages and you see like, oh, I'll just read this next chapter, and then that's only a couple pages, so you move on to the next thing, and so after you find yourself getting kind of caught up in the momentum of the short chapter, and since it's a little longer book than some of my others, I wanted to use that to my advantage.
There's one really kind of curious observation I made in your book as this person tries to undo their bottles. Nothing to do with bottles, but it does have to do with the fact that when Billy comes and revisits a lot of the people he knew in his adolescence, they're all living these really terrible humdrum lives. You've got the brothers running the theater.
So it's like the Hardy Boys are now working at a movie theater. They used to be security guards, but one of the Hardy Boys accidentally shot someone. They weren't supposed to even be carrying guns. And then
there's the investigative guy who's now, you know, the guard at the porn shop.
Strip club. And then Nancy Drew is kind of like a detective, but she's working for the bad guy because she really needs money.
Yeah, but this seemed really curious to me. Why not? Why didn't a single one of these characters have like a really positive sort of face?
Well, think about it. Like, Americans are really fixated by this idea of the child star. And there's very, very few film stars or television stars that as adults are happy or that are able to continue doing the work that they love. Most of them get typecasted or they, you know, develop drug habits or whatever the case might be. There's like all kinds of television shows, reality shows, behind the, you know, a true Hollywood story, all about these kind of fallen idols, you know, and people seem really fascinated with two kinds of story, either the story of like a character struggling and making it, or the story of a character having made it and losing it, you know, and this is the case of Billy, who has a lot of fame as, and all the answers as a child, who then as adult has a hard time kind of reconciling that. And so I felt like it, that sense of all these kids who are child detectives who are now struggling to keep their lives together on track was definitely reflective of the you know, our fascination with these fallen TV stars.
I don't know, though. I mean, it just seems to me that being a detective is a little bit different from celebrity culture.
Did you ever, if you read, like, everyone knows those kids, at least in the world of those books, right? Like, Nancy Drew is famous, or, you know, like, they go to the chief of police, and they're like, great job, kids, you know? Yeah, and so they are celebrities in the world of their own stories.
I get that, but I guess, because I view this book also, I'm going to go ahead and argue with you about this.
You tell me.
I view this book also as a sort of, as I was suggesting earlier, this kind of defense of playfulness.
Yes,
this
for
defense
sure,
of,
for sure.
You know, of like this kind of childlike sort of thing carrying on in positive ways and merging with like adulthood.
Being an adult, right.
And the fact that there isn't a single positive example of this in your book makes me say, Joe, what happened here?
Well, there is, though. It's just not easy, though. Yeah. I mean, I think I don't want to sound glib or negative, but think of how many people you know in your life that are able to do what they love, and that's it. And they don't have to compromise, and they're happy, they're paid well for it. There's I think the people I love, the people in my life, my friends, they all have to struggle to do what they love, whether they're painters or artists or teachers. And there's dark times that they go through in order to pursue what they love. And, unfortunately, the way the world is right now, the last thing that people seem to value is a sense of wonder or is a sense of playfulness, you know. So there's not too many people who get paid to run around blowing bubbles, you know, or to play Star Wars figures. And some people do, you know. But, I mean, I think it's a genuine struggle to be an adult, to be 30, and to maintain that sense of wonder, you know. So I don't feel, hopefully by the end of the book, the reader thinks that it's pessimistic to believe those things, but that it's difficult to hang on to that sense of joy that you get in not having the answers to everything.
Well, certainly it's difficult, but at the same time, there are two definite causes that are, you know, first of all, there is sort of personal crisis that's trying to kill the playfulness. And then there are these outside, having to make this, having this horrible job as a telemarketer for Billy.
Right, right.
So it's like both cultural and psychological.
When those two things collide, you're in dangerous territory. And I think it happens all the time. I think at least in my life, there's very talented people that I know, artists and teachers, who have to make that choice between what they love and paying rent. And so they take some job that their heart isn't in, but they have to do it in order to survive, you know. And so they have that pressure from outside forces. And then at the same time, you know, being conflicted, like, well, you know what, I'm sick of eating ramen noodles.
Yeah.
I'd like to have three meals a day. Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. Or, you know, I'm sick of living in this crummy apartment. And so I think everybody goes through that moment of questioning, like, is this the right thing for me, or, you know, should I go do this job that's going to pay really well, though my heart isn't in it, you know? And so definitely Billy working at the mammoth lifelike mustache, where he's talking to these people who are like heartbroken on the phone every day, and he is doing this job that he's really not interested in or invested in, and at the same time coming to terms with the death of his sister and his state, you know, where he's in the world right now. I mean, I think it's something, unfortunately, a lot of people can relate to, being in that, you know, that in that crisis.
Yeah, but at the same time, you kind of juxtapose this against the Mumfords, and who are kind of like, they're very interesting to me. I mean, I found them to be the most interesting supporting characters.
I love them.
You've got Gus, who passes notes and remains silent. Uh-huh. This is misunderstood Billy. You've got her sister, who is like, you know, as you described, this sort of future sort of scientist.
Right.
But at the same time, how can we be sure that she's actually going to turn out okay?
She will.
It's like, given your sort of, you know, kind of, you know, glum vision.
It's not. I mean, I totally disagree. Although there's characters in the book who are glum, I mean, by the end of the book, you understand that those characters, Gus and Effie, are definitely, there's brighter hope for them, you know. And what's important about them, and
but
what,
in your land of, like, you know, movie theaters and strip
clubs, they're
not
celebrities,
you know?
Though, you know, Effie and Gus, I mean, that's what those other characters who are like takeoffs on Nancy Drew and Encyclopedia Brown, those guys are all celebrities, and so that's why they're unhappy, you know. That's why they're in crisis. That's why they're working these jobs, because they had this I think it's really difficult once you get a certain amount of fame at a young age to ever replicate that. There's very few bands who are able, after having their first record be huge, to ever follow that up. And there's very few bands who are able to put out more than a few records. Great bands that are on the cover of Rolling Stone and Spin, don't have careers. They put out a couple records and then they disappear into obscurity. And I think, you know, there's musicians and writers who follow that same path. So that idea of the characters who are unhappy in their adulthood having been famous as children is a criticism of that. I don't in any way think that because you're imaginative or strange or look at the world differently as a child that you're destined to sadness. And those children, what they have in common with Billy is that they're smart.
Yeah.
They're intelligent. Gus Mumford is a bully because he's Gus is the smartest person in his third grade class. He's smarter than his teachers, and that's why he's unhappy, right? That's why he's taking a vow of silence. Effie wins the science fair every year, and so she's made unhappy because the other kids, you know, pick on her, don't appreciate her. And Billy is really, really intelligent. He's great at solving mysteries, and they're lonely because of their intelligence. And, you know, unfortunately, America isn't a place that necessarily recognizes or appreciates intelligence. You know, our heroes aren't Stephen Hawking or, you know, people who work in, you know, physics. It's sports heroes, celebrities from movies, television stars, right? So as a culture, we don't really value intelligence in the same way we value being good-looking. And so that's the struggle all those three characters have in common together, and each of them solve it or deal with it in their own way.
It seems to me also, because you had a pretty big success when you were 24, your first novel was put out.
Right.
And also, you know, this brings another sort of thing I wanted to talk to you about,
sure.
And that is you have stuck adamantly to Punk Planet books.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you had an early career where you were actually, like, published by a lot of corporate presses.
Right,
but
right.
I actually want to put the question to you, since the publishing industry is indeed a very sort of strange place. I mean, look, Mark Danielewski just put out Only Revolutions through Random House, which is one of the most uncompromising sorts of books I've seen from a publisher in a long time. I mean, is there something to be said? Does small press, indie press really matter if, like, Danielewski can get his book out there and, like, get it number 13 on the New York Times bestseller list the first week?
No, I think that's great, and I think it goes to show you how strong corporate publishers are, and the last thing I believe is in absolutes. I think there's a lot. Most of my favorite authors are published on corporate presses. My experience with HarperCollins and St. Martin's was really negative, and I'm not going to say that I'm not going to make some blanket statement that everyone else's experience is bad. There's a lot of indie presses that put out really miserable, uninteresting books. I just have to talk about, the only thing I can talk about is my own experience.
Yeah, sure.
And so I think what's important is that there's books for everybody. In my experience, in the 90s, we saw this kind of consolidation of different publishers who had once been in competition with each other. And so slowly there was this sameness, this kind of monotony in the kind of books that were being published. And a couple publishers like Soft Skull and Akasha kind of rose in defiance of that sameness and lack of risk. And then I think a lot of corporate publishers have already started to respond to that, you know what, we have to put out stuff that's interesting or edgy. We can't put out the same book with high heels on the cover and hope to keep our audience's attention. So there's always this really interesting relationship between the underground and the mainstream, and they kind of, you know, are in a cycle together. And I think you can't divorce one from the other, and I think there's great authors who are publishing books on both of those kinds of presses. It's just been in my experience that working with Akashic and getting their support, and really I've been fortunate that they've allowed me to have as much input as I had in the design of the book, touring, marketing, the promotion of the book, where with HarperCollins and St. Martin's I wasn't permitted to have any input in any of those regions. And I think because of that, the last couple books I've done have been really successful. And so I think it's just whatever an author's comfort level is, how much input they want to have into those choices, and that defines whether they feel like their experience is really good or not.
Well, at the same time, here you are now on the road 12 hours a day for this crazy sort of tour.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how long can you keep something like this up?
I don't know. I'm willing to keep trying as long as I have a publisher that's willing to support me. I mean, I think the worst thing that an author can do is assume that once you work with a publisher, whether they're an indie or a corporate, that you finish the novel, then your work is done. And that's not the case at all. There's a few authors who are already established, or they have such great support from their press that they don't have to do those kind of things. But for most other writers, they do have to do some legwork, whether it's doing interviews or whether it's going on tour. And, I believe in my book. I spent 2 years or so writing it, and I just don't want to leave it up to market forces or the wishes opinions of people who might open the book and review it. That seems like leaving a lot up to fate. And so I would much rather, I feel like I've written the book, I believe in it, and I feel really strongly in getting it to people is the most important thing for me. And so if that means driving from Portland to San Francisco,
to LA tomorrow,
if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes.
Okay. Well, I don't want you to fall over.
Yeah, no, that's
so,
all right.
But,
thanks, Ed.
Joe, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great, Ed. Thanks, man. Yeah.
Got a hangman hanging on the front lawn. Got an old maid wasting away in the living room. Kids in the kitchen and their mouths full of silver spoons. Got a paper full of yellow journalism. Arrests are our way to selling me words of wisdom. The small town crier's chilling with